In the name of God, most merciful, most compassionate, I appreciate your coming here rather early by our standards this time around. And tonight, as Dariush announced, the topic is going to be Islam and democracy. Islam and Muslims are in the news almost every day, and I might add with negative coverage. And with recent elections in Iraq and Iran, there is a rigorous debate in the intellectual community as to whether democracy is compatible with Islam. Can Muslims retain their faith and embrace modern democratic institutions at the same time? Or is it the case that at the end, Muslims have to choose between Islam and democracy, as some would indicate in the West quite seriously, that at the end Muslims have to abandon Islam, or at least relegate Islam to the sidelines of public life, if they are to have democracy, prosperity, and modern civilization. At least that seems to be the general consensus in the West. In fact, these questions that I just raised have preoccupied Muslim intellectuals and political activists for the past few decades in the Islamic world, myself included. You see, there are two camps in the Islamic world which have diverging opinion on the issue of democracy. Traditional Muslim thinkers generally agree with their Western counterparts that democracy is inherently incompatible with Islam. Modernist Muslim intellectuals, on the other hand, vehemently believe that democracy is in fact compatible with Islam. So on this very issue, you have two opposing viewpoints in the Islamic world. Tonight, I will provide a broad overview of this debate. Before we can start comparing democracy with Islam, we better have a good understanding of what democracy is to begin with. So that's why I decided to break up the lecture in two parts. First, I'm going to talk about democracy, what it really means. What are democratic principles and democratic values? What is democracy and what is not democracy? And after that, we're going to deal with the issue of Islam and the state. So that's going to be the game plan for tonight. And as I talk about Islam and the concept of the state, obviously I'm going to review the opinions of the traditional Muslim thinkers who think that democracy is not compatible with Islam. And also I'm going to discuss the tenets of the modernist Muslim thinkers that argue that Muslims can and should adopt democratic institutions in their countries. Okay, let's begin with an overview of democracy. What is democracy? As you know, the word democracy means popular rule. It was coined probably by the famous Greek historian Herodotus some 5 centuries before the birth of Christ. So democratic thinking has been around for a long, long time. We also had some primitive form of democracy in ancient Greece. However, political philosophers have been hard at work identifying the appropriate institutions and also the legal framework and the culture that must exist in order for democracy and popular rule to flourish and be institutionalized. So the question in political philosophy has always been with regard to this issue. What are the appropriate institutions, the legal framework, and the social culture that must exist in order to have popular rule? It is fine and dandy for us to glorify and celebrate popular rule, but it is just an abstract concept. Once you want to materialize it, then you have to have the right framework, legal framework, and political institutions to implement that. Now, if we take all the fat away, Okay, and get to the bare bone of the issue. What is the essence of democracy? In my opinion, democracy is a unique arrangement of power that must have two overarching characteristics. And these two are so fundamental to our discussions tonight. The first one is critique of power. Critique of power. In other words, political power is not sacred. Political authorities are not sacred figures. They can be critiqued, their behavior and policies can be questioned and criticized. Second characteristic of democracy is distribution of power. So the first one was critique of power, the second one is distribution of power. Power is not centralized in democratic societies. No one person or one office holds all the political power in the land. Socialists, however, amend this second characteristic, and perhaps correctly so. They argue that if distribution of power is limited to the political realm, political democracy will be incomplete. Let me repeat. If we limit distribution of power only to the political realm, and we don't extend it to the realm of knowledge and economics, the democratic project is going to be incomplete. Why? Because those who hold economic power in society will ultimately have the keys to the levers of power. In order for democracy to be complete, it has to involve economic as well as political distribution of power. Now, what is the opposing school of thought in political philosophy which stands against democracy? Well, obviously it is authoritarianism, despotism, and dictatorship, in which power is centralized. Power is unchecked. There is no balances to the ruling powers. People who hold power are not accountable to the people. There is a sort of a master-servant relationship that exists in the political structure. That's what dictatorship is all about. Now, as I mentioned before, as a system of government, democracy entails both a system of values as well as certain principles that must be used to organize the political life of the community. What are the values of political democracy? There are a number, and I'm going to briefly and very briefly go over them. The first value cherished in democracy is individualism. And I submit to you that the concept of individualism does not exist in the eastern part of the world. All of the Middle East, or almost all of the Middle East, in the Indian subcontinent, in China, they don't have the concept of individualism. What do we mean by individualism? It basically means that the individual is the primary unit in democracy. Every citizen is an independent character. The individual or the person is perceived to be an end in himself. Every individual has intrinsic value, is not good for something other than himself. He is not an instrument in the service of the state, society, political party, and so forth. That's what individualism is. Now, in democracy, this is one of the core values. If this concept is not institutionalized in a society, you cannot have democracy, or at least you cannot have liberal democracy. The second value, every individual has certain inalienable rights. That is, by virtue of being a human, he enjoys those rights, regardless of his religious belief system, his political creed, his social class, gender, race, so on and so forth. Insofar as the person is a human being, he has inalienable rights. What are we saying here? those rights are not given to the individual by the state or society. You see, if you think that the rights are given to you by the state and society, guess what? Those rights can be taken away from you. But democracy assumes that rights are inalienable. You are born with them. And as we will see, it was really due to Abrahamic faith that this notion took roots in the world, which basically means Islam, Judaism, and Christianity really pushed this idea forward, that human beings are endowed with certain rights by their creator. Those rights are not given to them by the state and society, right? Ancient Greeks didn't think that way. People like Plato and Aristotle argued that the rights are given to citizens by the state. So it was really Christianity in the West that pushed the idea of inalienable rights, which we have in our constitution here. So those rights cannot be taken away from people. People, therefore, are not classified as first class, second class, third class citizens, each class having their own inherent rights. The third important value in democracy is rationality. Rationality. This is so critical to democracy. Every individual is endowed with the power of reasoning. Every individual can make rational decisions and choices. Reason is not a faculty bestowed on the elite, right? Everybody, by virtue of being a human, is capable of rational thought. What is the extension of this value in political life of the community? Well, it means that political decisions and public policy are made using rational arguments and reasoning. Political conflicts are resolved through rational means, not by assassination, not by terror campaign, imprisonment, torture, and so on and so forth. You don't settle political issues and debates by these means. You argue, you put forward rational cases for what you believe in, and that's how you resolve political conflicts. Next value is freedom, which means every individual is a free agent. He has the right to choose who he is, not who the state or society wishes him to be. Right? So that's what freedom at its core is all about. Every person should be free to think, to choose his belief system, to hold opinion, and yes, be free to express it. The next value of democracy is pluralism. Pluralism. Democracy cherishes diversity in thought, in perspectives, in beliefs, preferences, worldviews, so on and so forth. Democracy never seeks to abolish diversity and replace it and reduce it to a superficial unity. You see, one of the problems endangering our American democracy today is the pressure by the right to force a sort of superficial unity in society. That goes against democratic thinking. Democracy is about pluralism, diversity of thought, viewpoints, and preferences. Now, these are, in a nutshell, the core values of democracy. In order for democracy to take roots, let's say in the Middle Eastern countries, these values must be adopted not only by the political elite, but also by the citizenry at large. If your citizens do not embrace these values, you cannot force democracy from above. Democracy is not something that you can package and ship overseas. People must embrace freely these values. They must cherish them and use it in their everyday lives. Now, this is the value portion of democracy. But democracy also has certain principles that must exist in the political organization of society. What are those principles? Number one, the people or citizenry consent to their government. So here we have the notion of consent. In other words, government must derive its power and authority from the consent and the will of the people. So it is the popular consent that gives legitimacy to the ruling powers, not blood lineage, not social class, not the power of the sword, not claim of divine representation, none of that. You cannot claim that you belong to this caste or you belong to this religion and that's why you should be the president of the land or the king on the nation. If people grant you the right to rule, then you can rule. That's what consent means in political philosophy. Now, in technical jargon of political philosophy, we call this principle sovereignty. Does it sound familiar to you? Sovereignty. Now, in plain old English, what does sovereignty mean? It means who has the final say. Who has the final say? When a dispute arises, who has the final say in resolving the dispute? In democracy, the final say belongs to the people at large, not to the clerics, not to a given political party, not to those who have the most money in society. The people at large have the final say in resolving disputes. By way of contrast, in theocracy, in other words, the rule of the clergy, the ruler's legitimacy is derived from religion. So that's the difference between, at the core, the distinction between democracy and theocracy. Who is the sovereign? In theocracy, sovereignty belongs to a ruler who points to religion as the source for his power. In other words, his affiliation to the official religion of the state gives him the right to rule, not the vote and consent of the people. The second principle of democracy is that the government should in some sense, and I want to underscore some sense, because there is not just one way, in some sense the government should represent the people, right? In other words, in democracy, the people are the principal and the state and government is their agent. This idea comes from social contract. In other words, in democracy, it's assumed that there is a contract between the governed and those who govern. Right? There is a contract. Those who give their consent are the principals in this contract, and those who rule are the agent. The third principle, the primary vehicle for choosing the agent of the people are elections. Now, if you, as you've noticed probably by now, that elections are just one component of democracy. This is the problem we have in Iraq today. A lot of people falsely believe and think that just because you have election in a country, you have democracy. That is not so. Elections are just one component of democracy, which means when people want to choose their agents, they will use the ballot box. People never ever vote to give up their right to vote in the future. Did you get what I just said? You vote to choose a leader, you vote to enact a law or a proposition. However, you never ever vote that you don't want to vote anymore. Because once you take the voting away, democracy crumbles, right? Now guess what? This notion is very prevalent in the Third World. All revolutions, typically in the Third World, are basically established in the name of people's sovereignty, with no exception. But what happens? Right after the revolution, there is a voting that takes place, only once. So their motto is, people vote. One man, one vote, one time. Now in democracy, we only believe in one man, one vote, not just one time. Revolutionaries, unfortunately, have such a hard time dealing with this issue. They think that once people vote them into the office for the first time, they are supposed to be there forever, till eternity. That's not what we mean by democracy. Now, the issue of elections and ballot boxes also mean that political conflicts are resolved by the ballot box, not by the sword. Democracy is a two-way street. Democracy can be likened to a game, right? Every time you play a game, there is going to be a winner and a loser. In the game of democracy, those who lose in the elections will form a minority. Those who win will become the majority. However, again, there is no permanent minority or permanent majority in a democracy, right? There should always be a chance for the minority to effectively become a majority in the future. That's what democracy is all about. Anyhow, democracy is a two-way street. Those who lose in the elections, they agree that they're going to be a minority. They will not resort to violence, assassination, bombing government places to gain back what they lost in the elections. Notice what happens in the third world. As soon as people lose in the elections, they resort to armed struggle. I vividly remember right after the Iranian Revolution, those who lost in the elections, what did they do? They immediately went back to using armed struggle to gain back what they lost in the elections. Well, this is the losing side of the equation. How about the winning side? Well, the winning side also is bound to respect the constitutional rights of the minority. It will not deprive the minority of their constitutional rights. It will not trample their opportunities to become a majority in future elections. All right, principle number five. Public authority is limited. Public authority is limited. In other words, significant areas of life are left to private and individual choice. In contrast, in dictatorships, the state covers so much ground that wherever you go, you walk on the state's ground. That's why there is so much scrutiny and so much regulation in dictatorial systems, because there is no individual or private space in society. The government has complete control of the private and public spaces in society. Very briefly, principle number five, freedom of thought, expression, and action is guaranteed in political affairs. Every citizen has the ability to criticize government policies and government leaders without fear of punishment. Now, I tend to criticize the third world folks a lot. Let me now criticize the Westerners in the 21st century. Democracy, remember, is always an incomplete project. Democracy forever is work in progress. Don't think that just because you have democratic institutions, they will be here forever. They need to be nourished. They need to be cared for, right? We should never allow freedom of expression and freedom of thought without intimidation be taken away from our people. If we do that, democracy will go on the decline in the West as well. And after 9/11, this is one of my primary fears, that now fighting terror may become a way to curtail freedom of expression and freedom of dissent. This is not good news for democracy. Yes, we should fight terror. Yes, we should secure a good life for our citizens, but it is not at the cost of losing the freedoms that we have, not at the cost of the democracy that we have. Now, according to this principle, every citizen has the right to ask political office holders to explain their policies. Questioning government policies should never be interpreted as either insulting the sanctities of the state or religion, or being unpatriotic. You see, that's what happens in times of war. Criticizing government policy may be misconstrued as being unpatriotic. Now, those who really believe in democracy must guard against this tendency in advanced democracies. This principle basically means that political leaders cannot wrap themselves in a flag or hide behind a sacred book to escape from being accountable for their policies, for their behaviors, and their actions. No holy book and no flag give political leaders the power to evade accountability. That's what this principle means. Now, what is more, you are free to express your opinion and thought, and there is an institutional guarantee that you will remain free after you express your thought. You see, in the third world, you are definitely free to express your opinion. However, there is no guarantee you will be free afterwards. Right? So that's what democracy is all about. You are free to express your opinion, and there is institutional guarantee that you will be free afterwards. Principle number 6. All adult citizens have equal rights to vote and be a candidate for political office. No one has any special exclusive right to the seat of power. In other words, the chair of the ruler is not reserved for a member of a certain family, a certain class, a certain religion, so on and so forth. Principle number 7, which is, I believe, the last one that I have. Organization of the state is based on separation of powers. You remember I mentioned that one of the overarching characteristics of democracy was distribution of power? So here it is. How do we accomplish distribution of power? Well, by separation of powers. Now, what is more, and again, this is a tendency we need to guard against. We need to have separate branches of power, and we must ensure that they are independent of each other. In other words, they are not in collusion with each other. Otherwise, they will rubber stamp each other's policies and laws. That's not what separation of powers is all about. It means authentically they are separate and they do not rubber stamp each other's policies. Now, in most so-called republican systems in the Middle East, yes, you do have separation of powers. You do have the legislative branch versus the judicial branch versus the executive branch. Right? There is only one problem. They are not independent of each other. They just rubber stamp each other. Well, that's not what democracy is all about. Now, the breakup of political power ensures decentralization, which in turn decreases the likelihood of authoritarian takeover of state apparatus. Perhaps better than anybody, Benjamin Franklin said it, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Now, those of you who followed the breakup of the Soviet Empire, remember those days? In my opinion, the fundamental reason for the failure of communism was the following. Communism as a school of thought had not envisioned an effective mechanism to control states' power. So power became more and more centralized. The more it was centralized, the more it became corrupt, the more it became abusive, the more it became coercive. Coercion and abuse cannot last forever. So in my opinion, that's a fundamental reason for the breakup of the Soviet Empire. Now, let me talk about three important considerations of democracy. Now, this is where I really intended to start my lecture tonight. Okay, so what I gave you was just a refresher. There are three important things that we need to consider when we discuss democracy. First of all, and please pay attention to this first one, it's because it's so critical. Democracy is a method for settling political disputes, not philosophical or theological disputes. Right? Now, most Muslims who have a problem with democracy do not appreciate this point. In other words, people vote to decide who should govern, not what the best religion is or which philosophical propositions are true. You never vote for those kind of things. Truth of philosophical and theological propositions cannot be established with majority rule. Right? We never vote whether it is the sun that revolves around the earth or the other way. We never vote for that. It is for the scientist to prove, you know, the truth in this matter. Truth is established by reasoning, sound evidence, and logical arguments, not popular vote. As such, democracy does not oppose faith and religiosity. There is nothing in democracy that says that in order to be a democratic society, you have to give up your religion. Democratization of society does not necessarily lead to a weakening of faith and religious beliefs. Besides, there is no evidence whatsoever that dictatorship strengthens faith and promote spirituality. We have no evidence of that in the history of whatsoever. If the Christian West is any indication, during the Middle Ages, dictatorship corrupts the sense of spirituality and religiosity in people. If today's Middle East is any indication, dictatorship and despotism does not promote religion and spirituality at all. The second important consideration that I want to raise here about democracy is the following. Democracy is neither a philosophy of ethics nor a philosophy of law. It is a misconception to equate democracy with moral relativism, that if you embrace democracy, you have to give up your strong sense of morality, that sooner or later we're going to have moral relativism in society. That's not true. See, democracy does not fight the will of God. Democracy does not fight the law of God. More specifically, democracy does not even determine the sources of the law. And again, this is so critical to our discussion tonight. In other words, democracy does not tell you whether the laws of the land should be based on a holy book, such as the Bible or the Torah or the Quran, versus human reason. Democracy is silent on that. Again, democracy is not about philosophy of law. Democracy does not dictate what sort of laws to enact. It doesn't dictate what kind of social, economic, and cultural policies to draft. In other words, think of democracy as a container that you can fill it with different drinks. Right? I think that's the best analogy. You can base democracy on different jurisprudential sources. You can have different types of laws. You can have different types of regulations and policies, so long as they do not violate the basic principles of democracy that we discussed before. And so long as your policies and the laws that you enact do not violate those principles, democracy is silent about the sources of the law. Right? Again, this is a very critical distinction that we have to make. Now we are getting to the meat of the discussion. In democracies, the judicial and the legislative systems follow the beliefs of the citizens. They follow the values and the customs of the citizens. This does not mean that popular views, the views of the people, have to supersede the views of God. It doesn't mean that. All democracy means is that laws, regulations, and policies should not be against popular will. That's all democracy means. Now, if the popular will is to follow religious values and laws, then democratic leaders and lawmakers will have to follow suit. See, a lot of people think that you have to be an atheist or non-religious to be democratic. It doesn't mean that. Not by any stretch of imagination. If the majority of a nation are deeply religious, by virtue of being democratic, their leaders have to follow their values, have to follow their ideas. In democratic systems, leaders and lawmakers ultimately obviously represent the people. If the majority of a nation has a strong commitment to Islam and wishes that Islamic values and teachings guide public policy, democratic leaders have to respect it. So there is no contradiction between being a Muslim and democratic at the same time. There is really no contradiction whatsoever. Again, it's a common misunderstanding that equates democracy with the preference of human will over divine will, or the preference of human law over divine law. When I give lectures in universities, I often come across this common misunderstanding, even in academic circles. Because when people talk about democracy in the West, sometimes they think that democracy is about the will of man above the will of God. It doesn't mean that. What contradicts democracy is not the will of God. What contradicts democracy is not the law or the rule of God, but rather what contradicts democracy is dictatorship and tyranny. Right? That's what contradicts democracy. In other words, today, in the 21st century, we have, around the world, we have two choices for organizing our political affairs: dictatorship and democracy. The choice is not between the rule of man against the rule of God. The choice is between the rule of one man against the rule of the people. Do you see what the issue is? And that's what is the source of a lot of the misunderstandings, especially in the Islamic world. And the third important consideration I want to make and then close out this section of the lecture. Democracy is very adaptive. Democracy adapts itself to the historical and cultural settings of a nation. There is not a one-size-fits-all when it comes to democracy. Democracy can be implemented in many ways. For example, public institutions in the US, France, Germany, England, Japan, and India are not identical. We all know that. Yet we consider all these nations democratic, even though their implementation of democracy is different. In a word, democratic societies are very creative. They fashion their democracies according to their own culture and historical background, not by emulation and blind imitation. Again, democracy is not a prescription that you can send overseas and people can blindly follow it and put it into practice. It has to mesh with local cultures, local traditions, and local norms. I'm going to spend another 15-20 minutes talking about Islam and the concept of the state. And then I'm going to stop, we're going to take a break and come back and continue the lecture. And I put the best part of the lecture, obviously, for the last, so that you stay around. And that has to do with, ultimately, with the relationship of Islam and democracy. Given this concept of democracy we have, can Muslims really adopt democratic institutions? Islam and the state. Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, had two astonishing accomplishments. The first accomplishment was that he was a conduit for the revelation of the Quran and the religion of Islam. That's what we know him the most around the world, for bringing a new religion for the people. But he had a second accomplishment that is typically overlooked in the West, and that has to do with the fact that he ushered in a new chapter in human civilization. We typically do not associate building of civilizations with prophecy. We always think of prophets and messengers of God bringing a sense of spirituality and religiosity to us. We always tend to think that building a civilization is not something that messengers of God are commissioned to do. Yet it was one of the chief accomplishments of Prophet Muhammad. He was truly a rare exception by any standards in this regard. Within 100 years of his death, his successors established an empire greater than the Roman Empire at its peak. Now here I'm talking about less than 100 years after he died. The Islamic Empire extended from North Africa all the way to India and everywhere in between. That was the extent of the Islamic Empire. After the Prophet died, his followers chose a successor to lead the community. And they named this successor in Arabic Khalifa, or in English Caliph. So I'm going to repeat the use Caliph tonight, which means Khalifa in Arabic and in Farsi. The Caliph was primarily a political leader who managed the Muslim community's public affairs. That was his responsibility. Right after the Prophet, according to the Islamic traditions, we had four rightly guided caliphs, or political leaders, in the order Abu Bakr, Omar, Uthman and Ali. These were the four rightly guided caliphs after Prophet Muhammad. However, things didn't stay that way. People in this period used to at least give some kind of consent to those who ruled and governed the society. What happened shortly, in less than a generation, is this type of government was transformed into a religious-based monarchy. And that was a massive transformation for the worse in the Islamic world, what we call dynastic caliphate. Now, in this dynastic system or religious-based monarchy, power changed hand now within one family. So you have one family and power would move from the father to the son to grandchildren, so on and so forth. And if the family was unlucky, a more powerful family would basically use brute force to take over. And now power would shift to this new family, but successively will move from father to the son to the grandchildren. That's what happened in the Islamic world less than a generation after the death of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. I can cite just two examples for you. The Umayyad Caliphate, or Khilafat Umadi, and the Abbasid Caliphate, Khilafat Abbasi, are just two examples in the Islamic world. Now, these dynastic caliphs were not Islamic scholars or jurists. Even though they had the title of an Islamic ruler, they were not a scholar or a jurist or necessarily a pious person. In their lands, Islam provided the ideological framework for state and society. All caliphs sought legitimacy as successors to the Prophet. That was their line of authority, not consent of the people, but the fact that they traced their lineage to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. Now, these caliphs were, in essence, as they called themselves, the commander of the believers, and their primary tasks were to defend and spread the faith and assure that society was governed by God's law. Now, many of them, they really did not believe in Islam per se. Many of them, they did not even practice the superficial aspects of Islam. However, when they wanted to set up a court, they would use Islamic laws in their courts to basically rule over the cases. That's what I mean by the ideological framework of state being Islam. Now, that period, obviously, is long gone. We don't have that kind of a system in the Islamic world anymore. However, believe it or not, today there are some in the Sunni branch of Islam that advocate caliphate as an authentic form of Islamic government. And let me underscore the word authentic. What does authentic mean? It means it was originally founded by Islam. If Islam was not around, we didn't have that system of government. So that's what I mean by an authentic form of government. So again, this idea has some acceptance in the Sunni branch of Islam. And as I mentioned, the Taliban in Afghanistan basically subscribe to this form of government, or at least they aspire to do it in the long run. Now, in the Shi'i branch of Islam, the caliphate was never embraced. The Shi'is never accepted that mode of governance as a legitimate one. So, historically, Shi'is boycotted government in the Islamic world. They didn't participate in the public administration of the Islamic Empire because they did not believe in the caliphate as a legitimate form of state. However, the problem still remained. As a functioning society, you must have a state and a form of government. The question is, what form of government does Islam endorse? Because when Muslims are a majority even in a country, they cannot afford not to have a form of government. So, as you probably know, the Shi'is are still in minority in the Islamic world, and up until about 400 years ago, they were never a majority in any nation. Well, things changed. In Iran, some 350 years ago, Shi'is became the majority in Iran. So, now that the majority of the folks are Shi'is, again, we have to have a government. What kind of government should we have now? Shi'i scholars started thinking very quickly and very seriously about this issue. A few of them came up with a theory of the state called velayat-e-faqih, or rule of jurist. That's what it means, rule of jurist. Now, this system of government is one in which a Shi'i clergyman or a Shi'i jurist heads the state. And in effect, he has guardianship over the nation. And literally, they use the word guardianship. Very much like the guardianship of parents over their children, in exactly the same sense and again the same manner. To these folks, and rule of jurist is the authentic Islamic form of government. And for those of you who don't know, this is the form of government we have in Iran today, rule of the jurist. Now, again, let me emphasize that only a minority in Shi'i Islam advocate this doctrine. And definitely no one in the Sunni branch of Islam embraces this doctrine. So it is limited only to the Shi'i branch, and only, in my opinion, a minority of Shi'i scholars subscribes to that school of thought. Now, having said that, it begs us the question, where did this doctrine originate from? If especially the majority of Muslims are Shi'a or Sunnis, and none of them embrace this idea, where did it come from? Did it originate from the Holy Quran? Did it originate from the teachings or the tradition of the Prophet Muhammad? The answer is clearly no. In order to find the answer, we need to look westward. We need to look into the political philosophy of the good old Plato. That's where the whole idea came from, Plato. In his famous political treatise called A Republic, Plato put forth his ideal state. What was Plato's ideal state? Well, it was a state that was ruled by a philosopher king. Let me explain what philosopher king means. Plato was not very fond of democracy, partly because of his dim view for the masses' capacity for sound judgment and rationality. In other words, he deeply believed that the average person on the street does not have sound judgment. According to him, ordinary citizens are incompetent to rule. Why? Well, because they are unable to see beyond their personal and immediate needs and interests. They are susceptible to the appeals of demagogues. In other words, you have an idiot like Hitler saying something and the masses blindly follow him. That's exactly what he was saying. He was saying the masses, because they do not apply reason to their decision-making process, they are very susceptible to demagogues. Now, you might say, what led Plato to come up with these, at least by modern standards, weird ideas? Well, guess what? His mentor and teacher, Socrates, was executed by Greek democracy. And you know the story, right? So Plato asked the following question. Socrates was the wisest man in Greece. Nobody was endowed with more reason than Socrates. And he was killed by Greek democracy. So what does it tell you? Popular rule can kill wisdom. So that's why he opposed democracy. In place of popular rule, Plato advocated a benevolent dictatorship. A benevolent dictatorship, which was ruled by guess who? A philosopher. Right? A philosopher. According to Plato, the root cause of all the ills we have in society is that power and wisdom are not joined in one authority. The people who rule typically do not have wisdom. The people who have wisdom do not have power. That is the fundamental problem according to Plato. So, ideally, it would be great if we could have a marriage of power and wisdom. And according to Plato, it was possible to do that. We could marry these two. Historically, kings had absolute power, and philosophers had a great share of wisdom and reason, right? He said, what is wrong with having philosophers as kings? And that's where this doctrine of philosophy king came into existence. Now, Plato's doctrine did not stay in Greece. It left its birthplace. Through the Christian West, it penetrated the Islamic world. Now, she scholars became acquainted with the Platonic notion of philosopher king. There was one minor problem here. They understood very well what Plato was arguing. However, in the Islamic world, philosophers were never held in high esteem. They were not regarded very highly by the general population. Instead, it was the jurists or fuqaha who held high moral grounds in the Islamic world. So what happened is a cultural translation took place. They replaced the word philosopher with jurist. So philosopher king was translated as jurist king. And that's the doctrine of the rule of the jurist that I just talked about. That's how this whole idea penetrated the Islamic world. Essentially, again, this doctrine is a belief in direct clerical rule and guardianship of government by jurists or experts in Islamic law. Let me summarize and close this section of the lecture, and then we can take a break. The folks in the Sunni tradition who believe that the caliphate is the authentic form of Islam, and the folks in the Shi'i branch who believe rule of the jurist is the authentic form of government in Islam, they have two things in common. What is the commonality between these two folks? First of all, both of them believe that there is something called an authentic form of Islamic government. Right? That is a very important belief. The second important commonality is that they both vehemently oppose democracy. They just do not care for democracy. They argue that democracy, first of all, has no precedence in the Islamic tradition. It is a product of Western secular thought. And furthermore, as they see it, in democracy, people hold the ultimate power, not God. In other words, in democracy, we have a man-centric view of the world versus Islam, or Christianity for that matter, in which you have a God-centric view of the world. That's why, according to these folks, democracy is inherently incompatible with Islam, because it grants the final say to man rather than God, and it basically chooses man's reason as the basis for enacting laws rather than the holy books such as the Holy Quran. So that's why they are fundamentally opposed to democracy.